be easier to sit down because of
the mic. Okay. Well, thanks very much for having me here. It's great to see quite a few familiar faces in the audience now as I look around. And I think it's great that this initiative is taking place, because I think what seems to me what's going on in schools education in England, often quietly to the extent that I suspect most of the public are completely unaware of it, and most of you of course aren't, it needs as wide a debate as possible. I'm talking, of course, about the privatisation of our school system, which has been well underway for a while now, I think, and which I find myself reporting on all the time in different ways. Some of the developments over the past few years I find quite astonishing. I suspect they're at odds with both the tradition of the governance of publicly funded education since the war and with what a large proportion of the public would expect of a modern developed democracy. Perhaps the easiest way to come at this is to give you a flavour of the stories that I've either worked on, read about, or had information about in the past few days alone. As John said, I do a diary column in the education section of The Guardian, which is getting deluged with tip-offs about various goings-on at local level, often to do with the academy scheme. I try to keep up and try to bring some of these controversies to the newspaper's readers, though sadly, sometimes I wonder if there are enough hours in the day or column inches available. So in yesterday's column, I reported on, firstly, the case of a school in Norwich where the local authority had proposed to sack the established board of governors, replacing them with its own interim executive board, and separately put forward to the Department for Education a plan to use the school's large site as the centrepiece of a learning village featuring a broadened education provision, catering for early years to adult education with community facilities as well. The local authority was proposing that this large comprehensive at the centre of these plans would retain its non-academy status. Lord Nash, the unelected academy's minister and Conservative Party donor who himself chairs another academy chain at the moment, wrote back to say that he was imposing his own interim executive board instead, without explaining why he was rejecting the LA's plan. Neither did the minister see fit to respond at all to the LA's Learning Village plan, which is seemingly scuppered by his own vision, which he has said will centre on an academy, because this is what, in quotes, ministers expect. Campaigners fear that the government will hand this large school site to an academy chain. If it does, there will be no way, seemingly, of even trying to understand the thinking and discussions behind such a move, as they are not made public. The minister and civil servants seem reasonably free to make whatever decision they deem fit. I also reported about another large community comprehensive, this one in Surrey, where the governing body is proposing to become a foundation school and an academy, and then an academy, interesting move, under the sponsorship of an organisation which has been providing its interim management for the past 18 months. The foundation school move would seem to be with a view to this organisation gaining freehold control of the school's extensive land, which actually, I learned, doesn't take place with a conventional academy, which gets a leasehold. The organisation itself has a recent history of developing school sites, including one very controversially with a building firm. On the school's website, the governors admit that the move would leave it, in quotes, free to plan for the future of the school to benefit its students without intervention from the local authority. And I wrote about a primary school, this time still under the local authority, where parents have been campaigning against a hostile takeover, which saw the long-standing head teacher replaced following a single bad Ofsted report. Again, parents fear academy status could be on the way for this school, which, in common with the other two, sits on a large and attractive site. I've also come across a story in the last few days of a school in Kent run by another academy chain, Oasis, being proposed for closure because this is what the chain and the Department for Education want. It's a troubled school. Even though the local authority argues that this should not happen because of local population considerations, there is a baby boom on the way. Just quoting someone now, Kent County Council has no voice in the decision, nor in the future of the site, with the premises on a 125-year lease to Oasis, who could decide to use them for different purposes, wrote the local education commentator, Peter Reed. 2 weeks ago, I wrote about the chief executive of one of England's larger academy chains being paid £375,000 a year, which is considerably more than the chief executive of NHS England. He is one of only three people legally controlling the chain at the head of its governance structure. Running close to 30 schools, I think, he is formally accountable and also the Secretary of State. He also sits on multiple school governing bodies, despite the DfE's own investigation into the controversial Trojan horse affair in Birmingham, suggesting that this should not happen. And as I say, the tip-offs concerning the Academy scheme alone just keep coming. These stories are sadly just the tip of the iceberg. I've reported in the last few years on Academy cases being imposed on schools under particular sponsors, despite in some cases more than 90% of parents being opposed. The highest I've come across was 98% opposition. Again, the vehicle for this was a simple letter from our friend Lord Nash saying he was right and by implication the community who used this school and have day-to-day interactions with it was wrong. So the Academy conversion went through in that 98% case, as in all the others, and Lord Nash, of course, will never have to answer to a local electorate. And this is despite, amazingly, official consultations being run such that the would-be sponsor gets to carry them out itself. I saw one such exercise where the consultation form for parents was published near the end of a multi-page brochure put together by the sponsor, stating how wonderful it was. Last year, I also reported on the new regional schools commissioner structure. This is the DfE's alternative to local authorities for supervising academies. The RSCs have huge powers on the ground, and not just over academies, but very big influence on the non-academy maintained sector as well. Yet this system was developed almost entirely in private through discussions between ministers and civil servants. There was no public consultation whatsoever. The RSC structure ignores almost all stakeholders within our education system. And astonishingly, I think, in a modern democracy, at the moment there is no public information about when meetings of the RSCs and their head teacher boards advising them or holding them to account take place, let alone any agendas or discussion papers. The DfE, rejecting an FOI request late last year, reportedly said that to provide this information would inhibit free and frank discussion. By that argument, I guess all parliamentary and council debates ought to be held in private too. This is a disgrace. They seem now to be proposing a partial climb down on that position, I think under pressure. Schools Week reporting before Christmas that the DfE would provide some public record of future meetings, though not ones already taking place. Although they still seem to be worrying about transparency issues, including commercially sensitive information, as they put it. Sadly, I could go on forever with this stuff, but I don't have forever. Trying to relate all of this to the themes of this campaign, I think recent trends in education back up very powerfully the importance of the three principles, which the flyer advertising this event says are being highlighted in this meeting: equality, inclusion, and democracy. I think the third of those, democracy, is the most obviously absent from so many of the developments I've already tried to chart. I use the word privatisation of our education system advisedly, although some would argue we don't have privatisation because full profit-making is barred in the running of state schools in this country. But I think what has developed is a system of private, or at the very least not very public at all, control of decision-making over what happens to our publicly funded schools. The obvious vehicle for that is the Academy Funding Agreement, the contract between the Secretary of State and Academy Trust, which sets the rules for the school or schools that are run by the Trust. No one, including parents and other citizens, gets a look in the establishment of that contract. That has important policy implications, since Academy funding agreements can be agreed without parliamentary debate. There was a concrete example of the implications of this last summer, by the way, with the former Education Secretary, Michael Gove, reportedly ready to react to the aforementioned Birmingham Trojan Horse affair by writing into future Academy funding agreements rules for schools to follow in relation to promoting, in quotes, British values. There was no need for any parliamentary debate, I understand, before doing that. It seems astonishing on such a contentious issue. As you can see, there is also a view that the DfE can take fundamental decisions about schools, what their governance status should be, which organisation sponsors them, and some of them, those organisations have got very different, they would admit, I think, they've got very different ethoses, without reference to a local community and without even having to explain in detail why it is taking these decisions. What has developed, I think, is an atomised school-by-school or academy-chain-by-academy-chain system. This solidifies a trend which I think was present even before the advent of academies, accentuating a system of institutional self-interest. In other words, our current school accountability system, including league tables, performance pay and very high-stakes Ofsted inspections, backed up now by the threat of closure and or takeover by academy chains, in hostile circumstances if necessary, now sadly sees those running schools incentivised first and foremost to think of their own institution's interests and results. I'm not saying, of course, that all schools do this, and I applaud endlessly publicly minded teachers and their leaders everywhere. But I think those that don't prioritise the needs of the institution are fighting the incentives of the system, which now revolves around thinking of the reputation of the school and its future survival above all else. Controversially, perhaps, I don't have a particular problem with the notion of competition between organisations per se. A little bit of healthy competition, I think, in life is okay. It's this notion that the system currently puts institutional self-interest at the centre, really writing off our traditional notions of public service, which is a deeper issue, I think. I don't like to overuse phrases such as neoliberalism, but what we have does seem to fit that as a defining characteristic of the current structure, that it encourages institutional self-interest. This institution-by-institution approach is very important to think about when it comes to that other principle mentioned in the flyer, inclusion. Sadly, I'm coming across more and more anecdotes of schools seeming to want to push out, however they can, pupils who might not help the results of the institution. In recent weeks, I've been told, for example, of a pregnant teenager being asked to leave a school which has recently been reported as improving in GCSE league tables in advance of her exams, of students having their A-level choices curtailed because of the school's drive for good scores, and of more tales of pupils being pushed towards alternative provision or even home education through unofficial exclusions. I think this goes beyond the mere anecdotal. A year ago, I carried out statistical analysis suggesting some successful schools were losing many students from existing cohorts as GCSE exams and their value to the school in league table and other accountability terms approached. Data such as this, though not on their own, never definitive, raise some serious questions about inclusion, clearly. The anecdotal stories are shocking, but they follow the logic of a system which says that the school's need for good results is what is important, rather than treating all pupils fairly and equally. In undermining deeper and far longer standing principles of public service, I think, which are going to be discussed here, I think this is not far off a tragedy. On equality, of course, yes, pupils need to be treated equally, as I've mentioned. Looking at one of the seven detailed key principles this alliance has drawn up, the equality of funding between schools, that seems very worth saying as a concept, especially as it seems to me in reporting on the academy scheme since its inception, that at least in the Labour years and running into the early years of the coalition, academies were better funded than maintained schools. I often wondered how that stacked up in a world where we're supposed to be using league tables to compare institutions fairly against one another. I'm not advocating league tables, of course, just questioning, as ever, the internal coherence of policy making. I've got a couple more thoughts. On the first principle, the national curriculum should be what it says it is. The position of England's curriculum does seem to me to be very strange, with the position of policymakers on the curriculum. In 2008, I reported on a House of Commons Children, Schools and Families Select Committee inquiry into the national curriculum. This, of course, has been hotly debated throughout its 25 years. Yet the remarkable thing about submissions to that inquiry is that almost unanimously they were in agreement that some kind of national curriculum should be in place. Yet fast forward to 2015 and thousands of schools no longer have to follow it, while Labour, unless they have now specifically ruled it out, it's even seen, and this may be that they've said something more that I haven't picked up on, but they even seem to be suggesting that no school at all should have to follow the national curriculum in their proposal to give all schools academy-style freedoms. If they're not saying that includes the national curriculum, I think they need to say it. The way this happened is that the first Labour decided to give some schools, who in the main were facing serious challenges, its first academies, the freedom to opt out of the national curriculum. Then the coalition extended it to many more schools. Now we're looking at it for all schools. Yet at no point has there been a national debate as to whether the national curriculum should be abandoned. Is that right in principle or not? This is very odd and reflects, I think, the short-termist, non-rational, ultra-centralised approach to education policy making we have had to endure in this country for at least 25 years. For example of that being taken to another level, by the way, try to get your head around the implications of proposals flagged up by Nicky Morgan a few weeks back. Primary school head teachers to be sacked if, for any 2 years in a row, the rate of pupils passing times tables and writing tests falls below 100%. If I had one plea in terms of the detailed principles the campaign is putting forward, it would be to ensure that parents and local communities are kept at the forefront as much as possible. I don't see them mentioned explicitly in the principles at the moment, but to me perhaps the key problem underlying the developments I've described is just how top-down our system has become. Effectively, the minister and his or her appointees decide, and the public just has to accept this. Yet there are very powerful arguments that this is wrong. Taxpayers have a right to know not just that decisions have been made, but why they've been made, the considerations behind them, and who had influence on the process, for example. And I've said this before, I remember reporting on the local authority at the start of my journalistic career and looking at school reorganisation plans and thinking, you know, that was the model. Things were set out, there was public debate. It's very absent now in cover. And hostile takeovers of school when a solution is imposed on a community against its wishes should in almost all cases be avoided. The underlying assumption seems to be that when it comes to schools, ministers know best and the parents and local communities ultimately get no say, or even often not even given the right to any information. That is a very weak position from which to argue, it seems to me. So I would say that emphasising the parental and community voice would be a very good and very powerful move. But of course, I wish this campaign to push for a principle of state principle vision of state education well. Thank you.